Well, thank you very much, and your excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. It is both an honor and a privilege to address you here this morning on a subject which for the last 10 years has profoundly influenced not only my responsibilities but also my intellectual journey. But as we all know, for a long time it was indeed an uphill battle to have these matters addressed in a proper way, because the doubters and the naysayers often occupied center stage. But recently, in the last year or two, we have seen a fundamental shift, primarily because, I would almost say unfortunately, the evidence is now overwhelming. And the latest research on the Arctic and the Greenland ice sheet indicates that the extent of the melting, which previously was expected to take place by the middle of this century, has already taken place. And the people of Iceland don't really need to read extensive international reports, because we are witnessing back home the alarming rate of the melting of the glaciers, glaciers which have for centuries, even thousands of years, been the largest in Europe. The pace of retreat in my country is now so striking that some mountains and valleys which have been covered by ice for centuries are now visible for the first time. In many ways, my country can be described as a theater of the climate change process. And it's not only because we have the largest glaciers in Europe, but also because, although it surprises many, we are also struggling with the largest desert in Europe. And we are, in addition, very much aware of how the Gulf Stream, sent to us by the courtesy of Mexico, encircles our island, joining the water produced by the melting of the Arctic, and so creating what can be described as the motor which drives the entire conveyor belt of ocean currents influencing climate not only in Europe, but also in Asia, in Africa, and the Americas. But Iceland, as was mentioned in the introduction, can also serve as an inspiration, as an example of how to battle climate change through comprehensive transformation of our energy systems. In the early years of my life, over 80% of Iceland's energy needs were met by oil and coal. I was brought up in a small fishing village where oil was the only energy resource. Now, 100% of our electricity is produced from clean energy resources, and over 75% of our total energy needs, including cars and shipping, are met by either hydro or geothermal power. In the lifetime of one generation, we have transformed Iceland from being predominantly a fossil fuel country into becoming a world leader as regards the production and the consumption of clean energy. And I strongly believe that if we could do it, so can others. And therefore, as we should remember, the fight against climate change is fundamentally a question about the future of energy. And global warming could clearly be slowed down or even averted completely if, I may say so, the Icelandic model were followed on a global scale by utilizing the variety of clean energy resources which are available to every country in the world. And when we began this process, we had been for centuries one of the poorest countries in Europe. And if such a country could achieve this transformation within a single generation, I fundamentally believe that there are very few excuses for others. But the problem is, however, the time on this issue is very short. And the hurdles are, of course, enormous. And unfortunately, it seems wise to prepare our nations and the international community for dealing with the consequences of climate change. A formidable body of scientists now have concluded that we only have 10 to 15 years to transform our energy systems in ways which could prevent irreversible effects of climate change. And I have this summer been president for 12 years, and to me it's not a long time. I know there are some people in my country who think it's long enough. But I mention it here today to indicate that 10 to 15 years is a shockingly short time. There are others who argue that we might have 20 to 30 years to achieve the same result. And in either case, it is indeed a very short period. And therefore, even the ultimate optimist might find it difficult to believe that our national economies and our global system could be radically altered within such a short time span. But I do, however, believe that it can be done. And I want to emphasize that very strongly here this morning. And in that sense, I am perhaps the ultimate optimist. But yet I am also a realist, molded by decades of involvement in national and international politics and decision making. And I know that the pace of reform can indeed be slow and often frustrating. Because even if you can, as we say in my country, lead the horse to the water with strong and persistent goading, it's not easy to make him drink. And it therefore seems to me prudent to follow two simultaneous and parallel courses of action. One involves the transformation of our energy system, our lifestyles, our societies, our economies, in order to minimize and preferably prevent climate change. And although, as I have said this morning, it is a colossal task, it can't be achieved. Especially if we are guided by the same vision and confidence which inspired the ending of the Cold War and brought mankind through the Great Depression and two world wars into a new security framework. But the other course of action consists of preparing for the disastrous consequences of the global warming, which is already on the horizon, to engage in a comprehensive and profound dialogue on the new security challenges facing us, on how to map out the global and the regional institutions and how they could tackle the task ahead. And when the Security Council met in 2007 to discuss climate change, some doubted that it was the proper forum for such a discussion. Margaret Beckett, who was then the British Foreign Secretary, argued, however, that the conflict erupting in Sudan was an example of the crisis which climate change could only make worse. And in the UK concept paper, it was argued that since no other international forum had addressed these challenges, a discussion by the Security Council would make a useful initial contribution dealing with such questions as how the Security Council could play a part in a more integrated approach to conflict prevention in connection to climate-related factors, and how the international community could prepare more effectively to support states or regions facing increased risks of instability due to these same factors. But others argued at that time that the Security Council was not the right venue for these discussions. They said that the General Assembly, on the other hand, where all member countries were represented, was the appropriate forum. But whatever position one takes on these procedural questions, it is clear that in the year which has passed since the Security Council held its open debate on the relationship between energy, climate, and security, a consensus has emerged that security challenges caused by climate change must indeed be addressed, and in a comprehensive manner. The International Alert Report last November claimed to identify 46 countries at risk of violent conflict and further 56 facing a high risk of instability as a result of climate change. The UNEP Executive Director Achim Steiner and other speakers warned the Bali Conference that climate change was indeed a security issue. And scholars at the University of Hong Kong have reminded us that it was the oscillation of agricultural production brought about by a long-term climate change that drove China's historical war-peace cycles. 3 weeks ago, Javier Solana, together with the European Commission, presented a report to European heads of state and governments, and its core argument was that climate change is already having a profound impact on international security, and that this development will be intensified in the years ahead because climate change aggravates the stresses and the strains both within and between countries, threatening to overburden those countries and regions which are already fragile and conflict-prone. Javier Solana emphasized that those most affected by climate change are not the countries most responsible for causing it, but rather the poor and the least developed nations. And many others have stressed this point. And thus, climate change could intensify the North-South resentment and pit major polluters against those most seriously affected, and thus widening an already troubling divide. This important report is the EU's first in-depth study of the impact of global warming on security policies. And it is interesting that a week later, it was known in Britain that Prime Minister Brown intends to establish a special National Security Council designed to combat the threats of terrorism and climate change. Increasingly, many small island states are giving high priority to these security concerns. For them, the prospect of the rising in sea levels and the increased frequency of destructive hurricanes poses a greater threat than any military scenarios have done up to now. And similarly, continental states with long and low coasts are rapidly becoming aware of what could happen. And this applies to prosperous and poor nations alike. Around a fifth of the planet's population lives in coastal areas, which are threatened by rising sea levels. And Hurricane Katrina and the fate of New Orleans was therefore a wake-up call, not just for this country, but also for all of us. In my visit to India last February, where I was accompanied by Icelandic experts, both in glaciology and economic and social development, we entered into what I called a missionary dialogue with my friends and many prominent Indian leaders and scientists in order to raise the alarm over what is indeed happening to the glaciers in the Himalayas. And this is a development that has hitherto been among the most neglected parts of the global climate change debate. These glaciers have created great water reservoirs for almost 700 million people on the Indian side alone, and provide the basis for both food and energy production. And if China and other Himalayan states are included, the impact of the melting of the Himalayan glaciers could drastically affect the livelihood, the food, and the economic security of over 1 billion people. Although more research, indeed, needs to be done in this area, some experts are already predicting that the Himalayan glaciers might disappear completely within the next 40 to 70 years. An alarming prospect for nations which together account for a third of mankind. But yet, there is no regional mechanism for dealing with this problem, for promoting the necessary scientific or policy cooperation. Perhaps the Arctic Council, which was established in the 1990s by 8 countries encircling the Arctic, including the United States and Russia, could serve as a model for what I have called the new Himalayan Council. Like the Arctic Council, it could initially serve as a forum for the promotion of the necessary research and consequently, hopefully, help to evolve a constructive dialogue on how to meet these drastic challenges. The Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, published by the Arctic Council in 2004, and based on work by scientists in the 8 founding countries, was the most systematic and extensive account of recent climate change until the IPCC published its comprehensive statement last year. And this Arctic report demonstrated that climate change was taking place 3 times faster in the northern regions than in any other part of the world. And I believe, therefore, that the Arctic Council and its development could provide both important lessons and constructive guidelines for India, China, and other Himalayan states, which could prepare for what might happen, unfortunately, in the next few decades. A council which could initiate similar programs of scientific cooperation as were created between Russia, the United States, and the other Arctic countries. But although the prospect in the Himalayas is among the most alarming to be found on this issue, we have to acknowledge that all nations everywhere on the planet will be disastrously affected by climate change. And it is therefore necessary that every state becomes a constructive partner in an advanced global dialogue on the security implications of climate change, even if this dialogue is mostly of an exploratory nature in the early stages. We need to move from the old ways of looking at national, regional, and international security towards an unfamiliar, yet highly urgent challenges that lie ahead. The international institutions which were established in the aftermath of the Second World War were based, as we all know, on traditional security analysis. But it's now important to emphasize, as is done by the recent EU report, that the multilateral system is at risk if the international community fails to address the threats associated with climate change. And therefore, I fundamentally believe it is both timely and wise to start examining these new security issues in a systematic way. And I will offer you here this morning the following list of 10 relevant areas based on analysis by experts and scientists, alerting us to the complicated yet important task ahead, to the conflicts which the warming of the planet could create. First, widespread water crisis caused by the drying up of lakes and rivers, by the spreading of deserts and the melting of glaciers. And since many of the Earth's biggest rivers run through many countries, the drying up could cause nations to take drastic, even military, action in order to secure their own water supplies. Already, the water systems in the Middle East are under intensive stress. Two-thirds of the Arab world depends on water resources originating outside their borders. And Israel might lose 60% of its water supply this century. China, with a fifth of mankind, only has an access to a very small, some people say only 7%, of the global water reserves. Secondly, in all continents, the reduction of arable land will have a severe impact on food security and create an acute crisis for hundreds of millions of people. And as we know, historically, the conflicts over water and land, the basis of agricultural production, have led to wars in Europe and elsewhere. And climate change would introduce gigantic dimensions into these traditional causes of military conflict. Third, increased flooding and prolonged droughts would intensify these developments and make it extremely difficult to deal with them in a comprehensive and systematic way, especially in the view of the fourth item of my list, migration. Migration between states, regions, and even continents could reach a level hitherto unknown. The migrants would be climate refugees trying to escape droughts, hunger, water shortages, and rising sea levels, looking for new and secure homes because there would have been destroyed by either storms or flooding. Almost 2 billion Asians live within 35 miles of the coastline. And a large proportion of them will lose their homes as a result of rising sea levels. The tsunami tragedy in the Indian Ocean 3 years ago just gives us an idea of what could happen. The fifth is the urge to enter countries which fare better in the era of climate change. And this urge could grow to such an extent that all the resources and capabilities of those fortunate countries would be threatened to the same degree as if they were faced with a massive military invasion. And furthermore, deep-rooted ethnic and religious tensions could escalate and might lead to radicalization and conflicts that would prove almost impossible to control. Six, fragile and weak states could be in danger of collapsing, and small island states could see all or most of their territories disappear. And thus, entire state structures could wither away, leaving the population in what we could call a political no man's land, and entirely reliant on emergency aid from abroad. And similarly, communities within states, communities with special ethnic and historical characteristics, might see the land destroyed, causing great strains on the capacity of respective national governments. The consequences could be some form of civil war or other prolonged conflicts. 7, climate change will also have a dramatic impact on our energy systems, on our capacity to generate electricity and harness the power which is the basis of our economic prosperity. Rising sea levels could damage oil and gas reservoirs and make some of them inaccessible in different parts of the world. And we only have to call to mind the problems of the Middle East in recent decades and the importance of oil to realize what could be at stake. But 8 is the energy resources in the Arctic, which amount to a quarter of the untapped global stocks. And these are also highly relevant with respect to the new security dimensions created by climate change. The placing of the Russian flag on the ocean bed by a submarine expedition last year was a sign that a new security era had indeed dawned in the Arctic. And the access to the region's energy resources could be a strategic advantage in the 21st century global economy. And the 9th is related to this, the opening of new sea routes caused by the melting of the Arctic ice, both the so-called Northern Sea Route and the Bering Sea Route. And those not only shorten the ocean trade routes from Asia to Europe and America in a revolutionary way, but they also require systematic arrangements and formal agreements and treaties if they are going to be successful. Involving Russia, the United States, Canada, and the Nordic countries. These new sea routes could become as important for global trade in the 21st century as the Suez and the Panama Canals were in their times. And as we all know, those canals gave rise to serious tensions and sometimes military conflict. And it is therefore clear that the control over the new sea routes, which climate change will open up in the Arctic, will confirm enormous power and wealth on those countries that find themselves in the key geographical positions. And the final element on my list here this morning is humanitarian crisis, caused by extreme weather events, which will become, unfortunately, more frequent and more dramatic, creating societal and cross-border stresses with the potential for multiple security implications. And when many such crises occur simultaneously, it would severely test the capacity of the existing international institutions. The global demand for relief action could put the Security Council and other UN bodies into a more challenging crisis than they have ever envisioned. These 10 areas of new security concerns caused by climate change, which I have briefly outlined here this morning, support the view expressed at the Bali conference that combating climate change would be the central peace challenge of the 21st century. And it is therefore of utmost importance to marshal our forces, both nationally and internationally, in order to prevent disastrous global warming, since the consequences of failure could aggravate old tensions and trigger new ones all over the world, spilling into violence, wars, and military threats. And countries in Europe, Asia, Africa, and both the Americas would be affected. No one will be immune from these threats to the permanent security of our nations. Within 1 or 2 decades, the dramatic transformations which I have just outlined here this morning, and some might think they are too dramatic, but I fundamentally believe that they are almost a clinical analysis of what could happen, would dominate the international agenda. And time is therefore not on our side. Metaphorically speaking, we could almost say that we are already close to midnight. And even now, the evidence indicates that the warming of the planet and the melting of the ice has taken place more quickly, as I mentioned in the beginning of my speech, than was previously predicted. And we must therefore seek guidance from the heritage which grew out of earlier global crises and model our actions with respect to the frameworks already in existence, on the treaties, and also on the institutions, both regional and global, which have up to now provided the pillars of the existing international community. The dialogue on how this should be done, how to proceed from this kind of analysis to preventive action, how to extend and develop our international security framework is, I believe, now a clear priority. We must use the next few years to build consensus and agreements on the necessary measures. Otherwise, the consequences of climate change could become more tragic than we ever imagined, causing upheavals in global institutional frameworks, especially the main one which was created after the Second World War. But we were able to contain the Cold War by a series of treaties which at first seemed unattainable. We witnessed the building of new democratic and free Europe within a single decade, transforming global politics from deadly confrontation to a more interconnected world. We were able to land a man on the moon and gain extensive knowledge of its landscape, but have now to face the startling fact that we know less about the Earth's ocean than the lunar landscape. The law of the sea, which was created a few decades ago after a prolonged period of negotiations, was a monumental achievement, regulating what before had been open to conflicts and confrontation. Its wisdom is now being acknowledged even by those who earlier were reluctant to sign on. The law of the sea can therefore both be a model and an inspiration for the task ahead. And for my country, the law of the sea was a triumphant proof that military confrontation and conflicts over economic zones could be replaced by legal and systematic approach to solving problems between nations. It guaranteed the security of our waters while enabling the nation to harness the ocean resources. It was an innovative and brilliant framework created by constructive cooperation between scientists and experts, legal minds and policymakers, political leaders and international authorities. And we now need a similar call to action, a visionary collaboration between brilliant minds, but accompanied by an invitation to all concerned, all citizens, to become involved, to be heard and to be counted. And as we face potentially the greatest security challenge of the 21st century, we must not allow ourselves to fail in this endeavor, because if we do so, our children and our grandchildren will have every right to blame us. Thank you very much.